artifacts, the whitish clouding of the lens that occurs with age, excessive ultraviolet exposure, high cholesterol, diabetes, and cigarette smoking, the amount of light reaching the retina of a healthy 60-year-old is one-third that of a 20-year-old. I spoke to Felix Silverstone, who for 24 years was the senior geriatrician at the Parker Jewish Institute in New York, and who has published more than 100 studies on aging. There is, he told me, no single common cellular mechanism to the aging process. Our bodies accumulate lipofuscin and oxygen-free radical damage and random DNA mutations and numerous other microcellular problems. The process is gradual and unrelenting. I asked Silverstone whether gerontologists have discerned any particular reproducible pathway to aging. No, he said. We just fall apart. This is not, to say the least, an appealing prospect. People naturally prefer to avoid the subject of their decrepitude. There have been dozens of best-selling books on aging, but they tend to have titles like Younger Next Year, The Fountain of Age, Ageless, or, my favorite, The Sexy Years. Still, there are costs to averting our eyes from the realities. We put off dealing with the adaptations that we need to make as a society. And we blind ourselves to the opportunities that exist to change the individual experience of aging for the better. As medical progress has extended our lives, the result has been what's called the rectangularization of survival. Throughout most of human history, a society's population formed a sort of pyramid. Young children represented the largest portion, the base, and each successively older cohort represented a smaller and smaller group. In 1950, children under the age of 5 were 11% of the U.S. population. Adults aged 45 to 49 were 6%, and those over 80 were 1%. Today, we have as many 50-year-olds as 5-year-olds. In 30 years, there will be as many people over 80 as there are under 5. The same pattern is emerging throughout the industrialized world. Few societies have come to grips with the new demography. We cling to the notion of retirement at 65, a reasonable notion when those over 65 were a tiny percentage of the population, but increasingly untenable as they approach 20%. People are putting aside less in savings for old age now than they have at any time since the Great Depression. More than half of the very old now live without a spouse, and we have fewer children than ever before, yet we give virtually no thought to how we will live out our later years alone. Equally worrying, and far less recognized, medicine has been slow to confront the very changes that it has been responsible for, or to apply the knowledge we have about how to make old age better. Although the elderly population is growing rapidly, the number of certified geriatricians the medical profession has put in practice has actually fallen in the United States by 25% between 1996 and 2010. Applications to training programs in adult primary care medicine have plummeted, while fields like plastic surgery and radiology receive applications in record numbers. Partly this has to do with money. Incomes in geriatrics and adult primary care are among the lowest in medicine. And partly, whether we admit it or not, a lot of doctors don't like taking care of the elderly. Mainstream doctors are turned off by geriatrics, and that's because they do not have the faculties to cope with the old croc, Felix Silverstone, the geriatrician, explained to me. The old croc is deaf. The old croc has poor vision. The old croc's memory might be somewhat impaired. With the old croc, you have to slow down because he asks you to repeat what you are saying or asking. And the old croc doesn't just have a chief complaint. The old croc has 15 chief complaints. How in the world are you going to cope with all of them? You're overwhelmed. Besides, he's had a number of these things for 50 years or so. You're not going to cure something he's had for 50 years. He He has high blood pressure. He has diabetes. He has arthritis. There's nothing glamorous about taking care of any of those things. There is, however, a skill to it, a developed body of professional expertise. One may not be able to fix such problems, but one can manage them. And until I visited my hospital's geriatrics clinic and saw the work that the clinicians there do, I did not fully grasp the nature of the expertise involved, or how important it could be for all of us. The geriatrics clinic, or as my hospital calls it, the Center for Older Adult Health, even in a clinic geared to people 80 years or older, patients view words like geriatrics or just elderly askance, is only one floor below my surgery clinic. I passed by it almost every day for years, and I can't remember ever giving it a moment's thought. One morning, however, I wandered downstairs and, with the permission of the patients, sat in on a few visits with Jürgen Bludau, the chief geriatrician. "What brings you here today?" the doctor asked Jean Gavril, his first patient of the morning. She was 85 years old, with short, frizzy white hair, oval glasses, a lavender knit shirt, and a sweet, ready smile. Small but sturdy in appearance, she had come in walking steadily, her purse and coat clutched under one arm, her daughter trailing behind her, no support required beyond her mauve orthopedic shoes. She said that her internist had recommended that she come. "About anything in particular?" the doctor asked. The answer, it seemed, was yes and no. The first thing she mentioned was a lower back pain that she'd had for months, which shot down her leg and sometimes made it difficult to get out of bed or up from a chair. She also had bad arthritis, and she showed us her fingers, which were swollen at the knuckles and bent out to the sides with what's called a swan neck deformity. She'd had both knees replaced a decade earlier. She had high blood pressure from stress, she said, before handing Bludau her list of medications. She had glaucoma and needed to have eye exams every 4 months. She never used to have bathroom problems, but lately, she admitted, she'd started wearing a pad. She'd also had surgery for colon cancer and, by the way, she now had a lung nodule that the radiology report said could be a metastasis. A biopsy was recommended. Bludau asked her to tell him about her life, and it reminded me of the life Alice lived when I first met her at my in-laws. Gavril said that she lived alone, except for her Yorkshire Terrier, in a single-family house in the West Roxbury section of Boston. Her husband died of lung cancer 23 years ago. She did not drive. She had a son living in the area who did her shopping once a week and checked on her each day, just to see if I'm still alive, she joked. Another son and two daughters lived farther away, but they helped as well. Otherwise, she took care of herself quite capably. She did her own cooking and cleaning. She managed her medicines and her bills. I have a system, she said. She had a high school education, and during World War II, she'd worked as a riveter at the Charlestown Navy Yard. She also worked for a time at the Jordan Marsh Department Store in downtown Boston. But that was a long time ago. She stuck to home now with her yard and her terrier and her family when they visited. The doctor asked her about her day in great detail. She usually woke around 5 or 6 o'clock, she said. She didn't seem to need much sleep anymore. She would get out of bed as the back pain allowed, take a shower, and get dressed. Downstairs, she'd take her medicines, feed the dog, and eat breakfast. Bludau asked what she had for breakfast that day. Cereal and a banana, she said. She hated bananas, but she'd heard they were good for her potassium, so she was afraid to stop. After breakfast, she'd take her dog for a little walk in the yard. She did chores, laundry, cleaning, and the like. In the late morning, she took a break to watch The Price is Right. At lunchtime, she had a sandwich and orange juice. If the weather was nice, she'd sit out in the yard afterward. She'd loved working in her garden, but she could no longer do that. The afternoons were slow. She might do some more chores. She might nap or talk on the phone. Eventually, she would make dinner, a salad and maybe a baked potato or a scrambled egg. At night, she watched the Red Sox or the Patriots or college basketball. She loved sports. She usually went to bed at about midnight. Bludau asked her to sit on the examining table. As she struggled to climb up, her balance teetering on the step, the doctor held her arm. He checked her blood pressure, which was normal. He examined her eyes and ears and had her open her mouth. He listened to her heart and lungs briskly with his stethoscope. He began to slow down only when he looked at her hands. The nails were neatly trimmed. "Who cuts your nails?" he asked. "I do," Gavril replied. I tried to think what could be accomplished in this visit. She was in good condition for her age, but she faced everything from advancing arthritis and incontinence to what might be metastatic colon cancer. It seemed to me that with just a 40-minute visit, Bludau needed to triage by zeroing in on either the most potentially life-threatening problem, the possible metastasis, or the problem that bothered her the most, the back pain. But this was evidently not what he thought. He asked almost nothing about either issue. Instead, he spent much of the exam looking at her feet. "Is that really necessary?" she asked, when he instructed her to take off her shoes and socks. "Yes," he said. After she'd left, he told me, "You must always examine the feet." He described a bow-tied gentleman who seemed dapper and fit until his feet revealed the truth. He couldn't bend down to reach them, and they turned out not to have been cleaned in weeks, suggesting neglect and real danger. Gavriel had difficulty taking her shoes off, and after watching her struggle a bit, Bludau leaned in to help. When he got her socks off, he took her feet in his hands one at a time. He inspected them inch by inch, the soles, the toes, the web spaces. Then he helped her get her socks and shoes back on and gave her and her daughter his assessment. She was doing impressively well, he said. She was mentally sharp and physically strong. The danger for her was losing what she had. The single most serious threat she faced was not the lung nodule or the back pain. It was falling. Each year, about 350,000 Americans fall and break a hip. Of those, 40% end up in a nursing home, and 20% are never able to walk again. The three primary risk factors for falling are poor balance, taking more than four prescription medications, and muscle weakness. Elderly people without these risk factors have a 12% chance of falling in a year. Those with all three risk factors have almost a 100% chance. Jean Gavriel had at least two. Her balance was poor. Though she didn't need a walker, he had noticed her splay-footed gait as she came in. Her feet were swollen. The toenails were unclipped. There were sores between the toes. And the balls of her feet had thick, round calluses. She was also on five medications. Each was undoubtedly useful, but together the usual side effects would include dizziness. In addition, one of the blood pressure medications was a diuretic, and she seemed to drink few liquids, risking dehydration and a worsening of the dizziness. Her tongue was bone dry when Bludau examined it. She did not have significant muscle weakness, and that was good. When she got out of her chair, he said, he noted that she had not used her arms to push herself up. She simply stood up, a sign of well-preserved muscle strength. From the details of the day she described, however, she did not seem to be eating nearly enough calories to maintain that strength. Bludau asked her whether her weight had changed recently. She admitted that she had lost about 7 pounds in the previous 6 months. "The job of any doctor," Bludau later told me, "is to support quality of life," by which he meant two things: as much freedom from the ravages of disease as possible, and the retention of enough function for active engagement in the world. Most doctors treat disease and figure that the rest will take care of itself, and if it doesn't, if a patient is becoming infirm and heading toward a nursing home, well, that isn't really a medical problem, is it? To a geriatrician, though, it is a medical problem. People can't stop the aging of their bodies and minds, but there are ways to make it more manageable and to avert at least some of the worst effects. So Bludau referred Gavril to a podiatrist, whom he wanted her to visit once every 4 weeks for better care of her feet. He didn't see medications that he could eliminate, but he switched her diuretic to a blood pressure medicine that wouldn't cause dehydration. He recommended that she eat a snack during the day, get all the low-calorie and low-cholesterol food out of the house, and see whether family or friends could join her for more meals. Eating alone is not very stimulating, he said. And he asked her to see him again in 3 months so that he could make sure the plan was working. Almost a year later, I checked in with Gavril and her daughter. She'd turned 86. She was eating better and had even gained a pound or two. She still lived comfortably and independently in her own home. And she had not had a single fall. Alice began falling long before I met Jürgen Bludau or Jean Gavril and grasped the possibilities that might have been. Neither I nor anyone else in the family understood that her falls were a loud alarm bell or that a few simple changes might have preserved, for at least some time longer, her independence and the life she wanted. Her doctors never understood this either. Matters just kept getting worse. Next came not a fall, but a car accident. Backing her Chevy Impala out of her driveway, she shot across the street, over the curb, and through a yard, and could not stop the car until it ended up in some bushes against her neighbor's house. The family speculated that she'd stomped on the accelerator instead of the brake. Alice insisted the accelerator had got stuck. She thought of herself as a good driver and hated the idea that anyone would think that the problem was her age. The body's decline creeps like a vine. Day to day, the changes can be imperceptible. You adapt. Then, something happens that finally makes it clear that things are no longer the same. The falls didn't do it. The car accident didn't do it. Instead, it was a scam that did. Not long after the car accident, Alice hired two men to perform tree and yard work. They set a reasonable price with her, but clearly saw her as a mark. When they finished the job, they told her that she owed nearly $1,000. She balked. She was very careful and organized about money. But they got angry and threatening and, cornered, she wrote the check. She was shaken, but also embarrassed, and told no one about it, hoping she could put it behind her. A day later, the men returned late in the evening and demanded she pay more. She argued with them, but in the end, she wrote that check too. The ultimate total was more than $7,000. Again, she wasn't going to say anything. Neighbors, however, heard the raised voices at Alice's doorstep and called the police. The men were gone by the time the police arrived. A policeman took a statement from Alice and promised to investigate further. She still didn't want to tell the family about what had happened, but she knew this was trouble and, after a while, finally told my father-in-law, Jim. He spoke to the neighbors who'd reported the crime. They mentioned that they had become worried for her. She no longer seemed safe living on her own. There was this incident and the Impala in the bushes. There was also what they observed of how difficult managing matters as ordinary as getting her trash to the curb had become. The police caught the scam artists and arrested them for grand larceny. The men were convicted and sentenced to prison, which should have been satisfying for Alice. But instead, the whole process kept the events and the reminders of her growing vulnerability alive and lingering when she would have dearly loved to have set them behind her. Soon after the scammers were caught, Jim suggested that he and Alice go together to look at retirement homes. It was just to see what they were like, he said. But they both knew where this was going. Decline remains our fate. Death will someday come, but until that last backup system inside each of us fails, Medical care can influence whether the path is steep and precipitate or more gradual, allowing longer preservation of the abilities that matter most in your life. Most of us in medicine don't think about this. We're good at addressing specific individual problems, colon cancer, high blood pressure, arthritic knees. Give us a disease and we can do something about it. But give us an elderly woman with high blood pressure, arthritic knees, and various other ailments besides an elderly woman at risk of losing the life she enjoys, and we hardly know what to do and often only make matters worse. Several years ago, researchers at the University of Minnesota identified 568 men and women over the age of 70 who were living independently but were at high risk of becoming disabled because of chronic health problems, recent illness, or cognitive changes. With their permission, the researchers randomly assigned half of them to see a team of geriatric nurses and doctors, a team dedicated to the art and science of managing old age. The others were asked to see their usual physician, who was notified of their high-risk status. Within 18 months, 10% of the patients in both groups had died. But the patients who had seen a geriatrics team were a quarter less likely to become disabled and half as likely to develop depression. They were 40% less likely to require home health services. These were stunning results. If scientists came up with a device, call it an automatic defrailer, that wouldn't extend your life, but would slash the likelihood you'd end up in a nursing home or miserable with depression, we'd be clamoring for it. We wouldn't care if doctors had to open up your chest and plug the thing into your heart. We'd have pink ribbon campaigns to get one for every person over 75. Congress would be holding hearings demanding to know why 40-year-olds couldn't get them installed. Medical students would be jockeying to become defrailulation specialists, and Wall Street would be bidding up company stock prices. Instead, it was just geriatrics. The geriatric teams weren't doing lung biopsies or back surgery or insertion of automatic defrailers. What they did was to simplify medications. They saw that arthritis was controlled. They made sure toenails were trimmed and meals were square. They looked for worrisome signs of isolation and had a social worker check that the patient's home was safe. How do we reward this kind of work? Chad Bolt, the geriatrician who was the lead investigator of the University of Minnesota study, can tell you. A few months after he published the results, demonstrating how much better people's lives were with specialized geriatric care, the university closed the division of geriatrics. The university said that it simply could not sustain the financial losses, Bolt said from Baltimore, where he had moved to join the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. On average, in Bolt's study, the geriatric services cost the hospital $1,350 more per person than the savings they produced, and Medicare, the insurer for the elderly, does not cover that cost. It's a strange double standard. No one insists that a $25,000 pacemaker or a coronary artery stent save money for insurers. It just has to maybe do people some good. Meanwhile, the 20-plus members of the proven geriatrics team at the University of Minnesota had to find new jobs. Scores of medical centers across the country have shrunk or closed their geriatrics units. Many of Bolt's colleagues no longer advertise their geriatric training for fear that they'll get too many elderly patients. Economically, it has become too difficult, Bolt said. But the dismal finances of geriatrics are only a symptom of a deeper reality. People have not insisted on a change in priorities. We all like new medical gizmos and demand that policymakers ensure they are paid for. We want doctors who promise to fix things. But geriatricians? Who clamors for geriatricians? What geriatricians do, bolster our resilience in old age, our capacity to weather what comes, is both difficult and unappealingly limited. It requires attention to the body and its alterations. It requires vigilance over nutrition, medications, and living situations. And it requires each of us to contemplate the unfixables in our life, the decline we will unavoidably face in order to make the small changes necessary to reshape it. When the prevailing fantasy is that we can be ageless, the geriatrician's uncomfortable demand is that we accept we are not. For Felix Silverstone, managing aging and its distressing realities was the work of a lifetime. He was a national leader in geriatrics for 5 decades. But when I met him, he was himself 87 years old. He could feel his own mind and body wearing down, and much of what he spent his career studying was no longer at a remove from him. Felix had been fortunate. He didn't have to stop working, even after he suffered a heart attack in his 60s that cost him half his heart function. Nor was he stopped by a near cardiac arrest at the age of 79. "One evening, sitting at home, I suddenly became aware of palpitations," he told me. "I was just reading, and a few minutes later I became short of breath. A little bit after that, I began to feel heavy in the chest. I took my pulse, and it was over 200. He is the sort of person who, in the midst of chest pain, would take the opportunity to examine his own pulse. My wife and I had a little discussion about whether or not to call an ambulance. We decided to call. When Felix got to the hospital, the doctors had to shock him to bring his heart back. He'd had ventricular tachycardia, and an automatic defibrillator was implanted in his chest. Within a few weeks, he felt well again, and his doctor cleared him to return to work full-time. He stayed in medical practice after the attack, multiple hernia repairs, gallbladder surgery, arthritis that all but ended his avid piano playing, compression fractures of his aging spine that stole 3 full inches of his 5-foot-7-inch height, and hearing loss. "I switched to an electronic stethoscope," he said. "They're a nuisance, but they're very good." Finally, at 82, he had to retire. The problem wasn't his health. It was that of his wife, Bella. They'd been married for more than 60 years. Felix had met Bella when he was an intern and she was a dietitian at Kings County Hospital in Brooklyn. They brought up 2 sons in Flatbush. When the boys left home, Bella got her teaching certificate and began working with children who had learning disabilities. In her 70s, however, retinal disease diminished her vision and she had to stop working. A decade later, she'd become almost completely blind. Felix no longer felt safe leaving her at home alone, and in 2001, he gave up his practice. They moved to Orchard Cove, a retirement community in Canton, Massachusetts, outside Boston, where they could be closer to their sons. "I didn't think I would survive the change," Felix said. He'd observed in his patients how difficult the transitions of age were. Examining his last patient, packing up his home, he felt that he was about to die. "I was taking apart my life as well as the house," he recalled. "It was terrible." We were sitting in a library off Orchard Cove's main lobby. There was light streaming through a picture window, tasteful art on the walls, white upholstered Federal-style armchairs. It was like a nice hotel, only with no one under 75 walking around. Felix and Bella had a 2-bedroom apartment with forest views and plenty of space. In the living room, Felix had a grand piano, and at his desk, piles of medical journals that he still subscribed to. "For my soul," he said. Theirs was an independent living unit. It came with housekeeping, linen changes, and dinner each evening. When they needed to, they could upgrade to assisted living, which provides 3 prepared meals and up to an hour with a personal care assistant each day. This was not the average retirement community, but even in an average one, rent runs $32,000 a year. Entry fees are typically $60,000 to $120,000 on top of that. Meanwhile, the median income of people 80 and older is only about $15,000. More than half of the elderly living in long-term care facilities run through their entire savings and have to go on government assistance, welfare, in order to afford it. Ultimately, the average American spends a year or more of old age disabled and living in a nursing home, at more than 5 times the yearly cost of independent living, which is a destination Felix was desperately hoping to avoid. He was trying to note the changes he experienced objectively, like the geriatrician he is. He noticed that his skin had dried out, his sense of smell was diminished, his night vision had become poor, and he tired easily. He had begun to lose teeth. But he took what measures he could. He used lotion to avoid skin cracks. He protected himself from the heat. He got on an exercise bike 3 times a week. He saw a dentist 2 times a year. He was most concerned about the changes in his brain. "I can't think as clearly as I used to," he said. "I used to be able to read the New York Times in 30 minutes. Now it takes me 1.5 hours. Even then, he wasn't sure that he understood as much as he did before, and his memory gave him trouble. "If I go back and look at what I've read, I recognize that I went through it, but sometimes I don't really remember it," he said. "It's a matter of short-term registration. It's hard to get the signal in and have it stay put." He made use of methods that he once taught his patients. "I try to deliberately focus on what I'm doing rather than do it automatically," he told me. "I haven't lost the automaticity of action, but I can't rely on it the way I used to. For example, I can't think about something else and get dressed and be sure I've gotten all the way dressed." He recognized that the strategy of trying to be more deliberate didn't always work, and he sometimes told me the same story 2 times in a conversation. The lines of thought in his mind would fall into well-worn grooves, and however hard he tried to put them onto a new path, sometimes they resisted. Felix's knowledge as a geriatrician forced him to recognize his decline, but it didn't make it easier to accept. "I get blue occasionally," he said. "I think I have recurring episodes of depression. They are not enough to disable me, but they are..." He paused to find the right word. "They are uncomfortable." What buoyed him, despite his limitations, was having a purpose. It was the same purpose, he said, that sustained him in medicine, to be of service in some way to those around him. He had been in Orchard Cove for only a few months before he was helping to steer a committee to improve the healthcare services there. He formed a journal reading club for retired physicians. He even guided a young geriatrician through her first independent research study, a survey of the residents' attitudes toward do-not-resuscitate orders. More important was the responsibility that he felt for his children and grandchildren, and most of all, for Bella. Her blindness and memory troubles had made her deeply dependent. Without him, she would have been in a nursing home. He helped her dress and administered her medicines. He made her breakfast and lunch. He took her on walks and to doctor's appointments. "She is my purpose now," he said. Bella didn't always like his way of doing things. "We argue constantly. We're at each other about a lot of things," Felix said. "But we're also very forgiving." He did not feel this responsibility to be a burden. With the narrowing of his own life, his ability to look after Bella had become his main source of self-worth. "I am exclusively her caregiver," he said. "I am glad to be." And this role had heightened his sense that he must be attentive to the changes in his own capabilities. He would be no good to her if he wasn't honest with himself about his own limitations. One evening, Felix invited me to dinner. The formal dining hall was restaurant-like, with reserved seating, table service, and jackets required. I was wearing my white hospital coat and had to borrow a navy blazer from the maitre d' in order to be seated. Felix, in a brown suit and a stone-colored Oxford shirt, gave his arm to Bella, who wore a blue-flowered, knee-length dress that he'd picked out for her, and guided her to the table. She was amiable and chatty, and had youthful-seeming eyes, but once she'd been seated, she couldn't find the plate in front of her, let alone the menu. Felix ordered for her: wild rice soup, an omelet, mashed potatoes, and mashed cauliflower. "No salt," he instructed the waiter. She had high blood pressure. He ordered salmon and mashed potatoes for himself. I had the soup and a London broil. When the food arrived, Felix told Bella where she could find the different items on her plate by the hands of a clock. He put a fork in her hand, then he turned to his own meal. Both made a point of chewing slowly. She was the first to choke. It was the omelet. Her eyes watered. She began to cough. Felix guided her water glass to her mouth. She took a drink and managed to get the omelet down. "As you get older, the lordosis of your spine tips your head forward," he said to me. "So when you look straight ahead, it's like looking up at the ceiling for anyone else. Try to swallow while looking up. You'll choke once in a while. The problem is common in the elderly. Listen." I realized that I could hear someone in the dining room choking on his food every minute or so. Felix turned to Bella. "You have to eat looking down, sweetie," he said. A couple of bites later, though, he himself was choking. It was the salmon. He began coughing. He turned red. Finally, he was able to cough up the bite. It took a minute for him to catch his breath. "Didn't follow my own advice," he said. Felix Silverstone was, without question, up against the debilities of his years. Once, it would have been remarkable simply to have lived to see 87. Now the remarkable thing was the control he'd maintained over his life. When he started in geriatric practice, it was almost inconceivable that an 87-year-old with his history of health problems could live independently, care for his disabled wife, and continue to contribute to research. Partly he had been lucky. His memory, for example, had not deteriorated badly, but he had also managed his old age well. His goal has been modest: to have as decent a life as medical knowledge and the limits of his body would allow. So he saved and did not retire early and was therefore not in financial straits. He kept his social contacts and avoided isolation. He monitored his bones and teeth and weight, and he made sure to find a doctor who had the geriatric skills to help him hold on to an independent life. I asked Chad Bolt, the geriatrics professor, what could be done to ensure that there are enough geriatricians for the surging elderly population. "Nothing," he said. "It's too late. Creating geriatric specialists takes time, and we already have far too few. In a year, less than 300 doctors will complete geriatrics training in the United States, not nearly enough to replace the geriatricians going into retirement, let alone meet the needs of the next decade. Geriatric psychiatrists, nurses, and social workers are equally needed and in no better supply. The situation in countries outside the United States appears to be little different. In many, it is worse. Yet Bolt believes that we still have time for another strategy. He would direct geriatricians toward training all primary care doctors and nurses in caring for the very old, instead of providing the care themselves. Even this is a tall order. 97% of medical students take no course in geriatrics, and the strategy requires that the nation pay geriatric specialists to teach rather than to provide patient care. But if the will is there, Bolt estimates that it would be possible to establish courses in every medical school, nursing school, school of social work, and internal medicine training program within a decade. "We've got to do something," he said. "Life for older people can be better than it is today." "I can still drive, you know," Felix Silverstone said to me after our dinner together. "I'm a very good driver." He had to run an errand to refill Bella's prescriptions in Stoughton, a few miles away, and I asked if I could come along. He had a 10-year-old gold Toyota Camry with automatic transmission and 39,000 miles on the odometer. It was pristine, inside and out. He backed out of a narrow parking space and zipped out of the garage. His hands did not shake. Taking the streets of Canton at dusk on a new moon night, he brought the car to an even stop at the red lights, signaled when he was supposed to, took turns without a hitch. I was, I admit, braced for disaster. The risk of a fatal car crash with a driver who's 85 or older is more than 3 times higher than it is with a teenage driver. The very old are the highest risk drivers on the road. I thought of Alice's wreck and considered how lucky she was that no child had been in her neighbor's yard. A few months earlier in Los Angeles, George Weller was convicted of manslaughter after he confused the accelerator with the brake pedal and plowed his Buick into a crowd of shoppers at the Santa Monica Farmers Market. 10 people were killed, and more than 60 were injured. He was 86. But Felix showed no difficulties. At one point during our drive, poorly marked road construction at an intersection channeled our line of cars almost directly into oncoming traffic. Felix corrected course swiftly, pulling over into the proper lane. There was no saying how much longer he would be able to count on his driving ability. Someday the hour would come when he would have to give up his keys. At that moment, though, he wasn't concerned. He was glad simply to be on the road. The evening traffic was thin as he turned onto Route 138. He brought the Camry to a tick over the 45-mile-per-hour speed limit. He had his window rolled down and his elbow on the sash. The air was clear and cool, and we listened to the sound of the wheels on the pavement. "The night is lovely, isn't it?" he said. 3. Dependence. It is not death that the very old tell me they fear. It is what happens short of death, losing their hearing, their memory, their best friends, their way of life. As Felix put it to me, old age is a continuous series of losses. Philip Roth put it more bitterly in his novel Everyman. Old age is not a battle. Old age is a massacre. With luck and fastidiousness, eating well, exercising, keeping our blood pressure under control, getting medical help when we need it, people can often live and manage a very long time. But eventually the losses accumulate to the point where life's daily requirements become more than we can physically or mentally manage on our own. As fewer of us are struck dead out of the blue, most of us will spend significant periods of our lives too reduced and debilitated to live independently. We do not like to think about this eventuality. As a result, most of us are unprepared for it. We rarely pay more than glancing attention to how we live when we need help until it's too late to do much about it. When Felix came to this crossroads, the orthopedic shoe to drop wasn't his. It was Bella's. Year by year, I witnessed the progression in her difficulties. Felix remained in astonishingly good health right into his 90s. He had no medical crises and maintained his weekly exercise regimen. He continued to teach chaplaincy students about geriatrics and to serve on Orchard Cove's health committee. He didn't even have to stop driving. But Bella was fading. She lost her vision completely. Her hearing became poor. Her memory became markedly impaired. When we had dinner, she had to be reminded more than once that I was sitting across from her. She and Felix felt the sorrows of their losses, but also the pleasures of what they still had. Although she might not have been able to remember me or others she didn't know too well, she enjoyed company and conversation and sought both out. Moreover, she and Felix still had their own private, decades-long conversation that had never stopped. He found great purpose in caring for her, and she, likewise, found great meaning in being there for him. The physical presence of each other gave them comfort. He dressed her, bathed her, helped feed her. When they walked, they held hands. At night, they lay in bed in each other's arms, awake and nestling for a while, before finally drifting off to sleep. Those moments, Felix said, remained among their most cherished. He felt they knew each other and loved each other more than at any time in their nearly 70 years together. One day, however, they had an experience that revealed just how fragile their life had become. Bella developed a cold, causing fluid to accumulate in her ears. An eardrum ruptured, and with that, she became totally deaf. That was all it took to sever the thread between them. With her blindness and memory problems, the hearing loss made it impossible for Felix to achieve any kind of communication with her. He tried drawing out letters on the palm of her hand, but she couldn't make them out. Even the simplest matters, getting her dressed, for instance, became a nightmare of confusion for her. Without sensory grounding, she lost track of time of day. She grew severely confused, at times delusional and agitated. He couldn't take care of her. He became exhausted from stress and lack of sleep. He didn't know what to do, but there was a system for such situations. The people at the residence proposed transferring her to a skilled nursing unit, a nursing home floor. He couldn't bear the thought of it. No, he said. She needed to stay at home with him. Before the issue was forced, they got a reprieve. 2.5 weeks into the ordeal, Bella's right eardrum mended, and although the hearing in her left ear was lost permanently, the hearing in her right ear came back. "Our communication is more difficult," Felix said, "but at least it is possible." I asked what he would do if the hearing in her right ear went again, or if there were some other such catastrophe, and he told me he didn't know. "I'm in dread of what would happen if she becomes too hard for me to care for," he said. "I try not to think too far ahead. I don't think about next year. It's too depressing. I just think about next week." It's the route people take the world over, and that is understandable. But it tends to backfire. Eventually, the crisis they dreaded arrived. They were walking together when suddenly Bella fell. He wasn't sure what had happened. They'd been walking slowly. The ground was flat. He'd had her by the arm. But she went down in a heap and snapped the fibula in both her legs, the long, thin outer bone that runs from knee to ankle. The emergency room doctors had to cast each of her limbs to above the knee. What Felix feared most had happened. Her needs became massively more than he could handle. Bella was forced to move to the nursing home floor, where she could have round-the-clock aides and nurses looking after her. You might think that this would have been a relief for both Bella and Felix, lifting all kinds of burdens of physical care from them. But the experience was more complicated than that. On the one hand, the staff members were nothing but professional. They took over most of the tasks Felix had long managed so laboriously, the bathing, toileting, dressing, and all the other routine needs of a person who has become severely disabled. They freed him to spend his time as he wished, whether with Bella or on his own. But for all the staff members' efforts, Felix and Bella could find their presence exasperating. Some tended to Bella more as a patient than as a person. She had a certain way she liked her hair brushed, for instance, but no one asked or figured it out. Felix had worked out the best method to cut up her food so she could swallow it without difficulty, how to position her so she was most comfortable, how to dress her the way she preferred. But no matter how much he tried to show the staff, many of them did not see the point. Sometimes, in exasperation, he'd give up and simply redo whatever they had done, causing conflict and resentment. "We were getting in each other's way," Felix said. He worried, too, that the unfamiliar surroundings were making Bella confused. After a few days, he decided to move her back home. He'd just have to figure out how to deal with her. Their apartment was only a floor away, but somehow that made all the difference. Exactly why can be hard to pinpoint. Felix still ended up hiring an around-the-clock staff of nurses and aides, and the remaining 6 weeks until the casts could come off were physically exhausting for him, yet he was relieved. He and Bella felt more control over her life. She was in her own place, in her own bed, with him beside her. And that mattered tremendously to him. Because 4 days after the casts came off, 4 days after she'd begun walking again, she died. They'd sat down to lunch. She turned to him and said, "I don't feel well." Then she collapsed. An ambulance whisked her to the local hospital. He didn't want to slow the medics down. So he let them go and he followed after in his car. She died in the short time between her arrival and his. When I saw him 3 months later, he was still despondent. "I feel as if a part of my body is missing. I feel as if I have been dismembered," he told me. His voice cracked and his eyes were rimmed red. He had one great solace, however, that she hadn't suffered, that she'd got to spend her last few weeks in peace at home, in the warmth of their long love, instead of up on a nursing floor, a lost and disoriented patient. Alice Hobson had something very much like the same dread of leaving her home. It was the one place where she felt she belonged and remained in charge of her life. But after the incident with the men who had victimized her, it was apparent that she wasn't safe living on her own anymore. My father-in-law organized a few visits to senior living residences for her. "She didn't care for this process," Jim said, "but she reconciled herself to it." He was determined to find a place she would like and thrive in. But it was not to be. As I watched the aftermath, I gradually began to understand the reasons why, and they were reasons that bring into question our entire system of care for the dependent and debilitated. Jim looked for a place that was within a reasonable driving distance for the family and within a price range she could afford with the proceeds of selling her house. He also wanted a community that offered a continuum of care, much like Orchard Cove, where I visited Felix and Bella, with apartments for independent living and a floor with the around-the-clock nursing capabilities that she might someday need. He came up with a variety of places for them to visit, nearer ones and farther ones, for-profit and not-for-profit. The place Alice ultimately chose was a high-rise senior living complex that I will call Longwood House, a non-profit facility affiliated with the Episcopal Church. Some of her friends from church lived there. The drive to and from Jim's home was barely 10 minutes. The community was active and thriving. To Alice and the family, it had by far the greatest appeal. "Most of the others were too commercial," Jim said. Her one-bedroom independent living apartment was more spacious than I'd expected. It had a full kitchen, enough room for her dining set, and plenty of light. My mother-in-law, Nan, made sure it got a fresh coat of paint and arranged for a decorator Alice had used before to help place furniture and hang pictures. It means something when you can move in and see all your things in their own places, your own silver in your kitchen drawer, Nan said. But when I saw Alice a few weeks after her move, she didn't seem at all happy or adjusted. Never one to complain, she didn't say anything angry or sad or bitter, but she was withdrawn in a way I hadn't seen before. She remained recognizably herself, but the light had gone out from behind her eyes. At first, I thought that this had to do with the loss of her car and the freedom that came with it. When she moved into Longwood House, she'd brought her Chevy Impala and fully intended to keep driving, but on her very first day there, when she went to take the car out for some errands, it was gone. She called the police and reported it stolen. An officer arrived, took a description, looked for clues, and promised an investigation. A while later, Jim arrived and, on a hunch, looked in the giant food store parking lot next door. There it was. She had got confused and parked in the wrong lot without realizing it. Mortified, she gave up driving for good. In one day, she lost her car as well as her home. But there seemed to be more to her sense of loss and unhappiness. She had a kitchen but stopped cooking. She took her meals in the Longwood House dining room with everyone else, but ate little, lost weight, and didn't seem to like having the company. She avoided organized group activities, even the ones she might have enjoyed. A sewing circle like the one she'd had at her church, a book group, gym and fitness classes, trips to the Kennedy Center. The community offered opportunities to organize activities of your own if you didn't like what was on offer, but she stuck to herself. We thought she was depressed. Jim and Nan took her to see a doctor who put her on medication. It didn't help. Somewhere along the 7-mile drive between the house she'd given up on Greencastle Street and Longwood House, her life fundamentally changed in ways she did not want, but could do nothing about. The idea of being unhappy in a place as comfortable as Longwood House would have seemed laughable at one time. In 1913, Mabel Nassau, a Columbia University graduate student, conducted a neighborhood study of the living conditions of 100 elderly people in Greenwich Village, 65 women and 35 men. In this era before pensions and Social Security, all were poor. Only 27 were able to support themselves, living off savings, taking in lodgers, or doing odd jobs like selling newspapers, cleaning homes, mending umbrellas. Most were too ill or debilitated to work. One woman, for instance, whom Nassau called Mrs. C, was a 62-year-old widow who'd made just enough as a domestic servant to afford a small back room with an oil stove in a rooming house. Illness had recently ended her work, however, and she now had severe leg swelling with varicose veins that left her bedbound. Miss S was unusually sick and had a 72-year-old brother with diabetes who, in this era before insulin treatment, was fast becoming crippled and emaciated as the disease killed him. Mr. M was a 67-year-old Irish former longshoreman who'd been left disabled by a paralytic stroke. A large number had become simply feeble, by which Nassau seemed to mean that they were too senile to manage for themselves. Unless family could take such people in, they had virtually no options left except a poorhouse or almshouse, as it was often called. These institutions went back centuries in Europe and the United States. If you were elderly and in need of help but did not have a child or independent wealth to fall back on, a poorhouse was your only source of shelter. Poorhouses were grim, odious places to be incarcerated, and that was the telling term used at the time. They housed poor of all types. Elderly paupers, out-of-luck immigrants, young drunks, the mentally ill, and their function was to put the inmates to work for their presumed intemperance and moral turpitude. Supervisors usually treated elderly paupers leniently in work assignments, but they were inmates like the rest. Husbands and wives were separated. Basic physical care was lacking. Filth and dilapidation were the norm. A 1912 report from the Illinois State Charities Commission described one county's poorhouse as unfit to decently house animals. The men and women lived without any attempt at classification by age or needs in bare 10-by-12-foot rooms infested with bedbugs. Rats and mice overrun the place. Flies swarm the food. There are no bathtubs. A 1909 Virginia report described elderly people dying untended, receiving inadequate nutrition and care, and contracting tuberculosis from uncontrolled contagion. Funds were chronically inadequate for disabled care. In one case, the report noted, a warden, faced with a woman who tended to wander off and no staff to mind her, made her carry a 28-pound ball and chain. Nothing provoked greater terror for the aged than the prospect of such institutions. Nonetheless, by the 1920s and 1930s, when Alice and Richmond Hobson were young, 2/3 of poorhouse residents were elderly. Gilded Age prosperity had sparked embarrassment about these conditions. Then the Great Depression sparked a nationwide protest movement. Elderly middle-class people who'd worked and saved all their lives found their savings wiped out. In 1935, with the passage of Social Security, the United States joined Europe in creating a system of national pensions. Suddenly, a widow's future was secure, and retirement, once the exclusive provenance of the rich, became a mass phenomenon. In time, poorhouses passed from memory in the industrialized world, but they persist elsewhere. In developing countries, they have become common, because economic growth is breaking up the extended family without yet producing the affluence to protect the elderly from poverty and neglect. In India, I have noticed that the existence of such places is often unacknowledged, but on a recent visit to New Delhi, I readily found examples. Their appearance seemed straight out of Dickens, or those old state reports. The Guru Vishram Vrid Ashram, for instance, is a charity-run old-age home in a slum on the south edge of New Delhi, where open sewage ran in the streets and emaciated dogs rummaged in piles of trash. The home is a converted warehouse, a vast open room with scores of disabled elderly people on cots and floor mattresses pushed up against one another like a large sheet of postage stamps. The proprietor, G.P. Bhagat, who appeared to be in his 40s, was clean-cut and professional-looking, with a cell phone that rang every 2 minutes. He said he'd been called by God to open the place 8 years before and subsisted on donations. He said he never turned anyone away as long as he had an open bed. About half of the residents were deposited there by retirement homes and hospitals if they couldn't pay their bills. The other half were found in the streets and parks by volunteers or the police. All suffered from a combination of debility and poverty. The place had more than 100 people when I visited. The youngest was 60, and the oldest passed a century. Those on the first floor had only moderate needs. Among them, I met a Sikh man crawling awkwardly along the ground in a squat like a slow-moving frog, hands, feet. He said he used to own an electrical shop in an upscale section of New Delhi. His daughter became an accountant, his son a software engineer. 2 years ago, something happened to him. He described chest pain and what sounded like a series of strokes. He spent 2.5 months in the hospital, paralyzed. The bills rose. His family stopped visiting. Eventually, the hospital dropped him off here. Bhagat said he sent a message to the family through the police saying the man would like to come home. They denied knowing him. Up a narrow staircase was the second floor ward for patients with dementia and other severe disabilities. An old man stood by a wall wailing out-of-tune songs at the top of his lungs. Next to him, a woman with white cataractal eyes muttered to herself. Several staff members worked their way through the residents, feeding them and keeping them clean the best they could. The din and the smell of urine were overpowering. I tried to talk to a couple of the residents through my translator, but they were too confused to answer questions. A deaf and blind woman lying on a mattress nearby was shouting a few words over and over again. I asked the translator what she was saying. The translator shook her head. The words made no sense, and then she bolted down the stairs. It was too much for her. It was as close to a vision of hell as I've ever experienced. "These people are on the last stage of their journey," Bhagat said, looking out upon the mass of bodies. "But I can't provide the kind of facility they really require." In the course of Alice's lifetime, the industrialized world's elderly have escaped the threat of such a fate. Prosperity has enabled even the poor to expect nursing homes with square meals, professional health services, physical therapy, and bingo. They've eased debility and old age for millions and made proper care and safety a norm to an extent that the inmates of poorhouses could not imagine. Yet still, most consider modern old age homes frightening, desolate, even odious places to spend the last phase of one's life. We need and desire something more. Longwood House seemingly had everything going for it. The facility was up to date, with top ratings for safety and care. Alice's quarters enabled her to have the comforts of her old home in a safer, more manageable situation. The arrangements were tremendously reassuring for her children and extended family, but they weren't for Alice. She never got used to being there or accepted it. No matter what the staff or family did for her, she grew only more miserable. I asked her about this, but she couldn't put her finger on what made her unhappy. The most common complaint she made is one I've heard often from nursing home residents I've met. It just isn't home. To Alice, Longwood House was a mere facsimile of home. And having a place that genuinely feels like your home can seem as essential to a person as water to a fish. A few years ago, I read about the case of Harry Truman, an 83-year-old man who, in March 1980, refused to budge from his home at the foot of Mount St. Helens near Olympia, Washington, when the volcano began to steam and rumble. A former World War I pilot and Prohibition-era bootlegger, he'd owned his lodge on Spirit Lake for more than half a century. 5 years earlier, he'd been widowed. So now it was just him and his 16 cats on his 54 acres of property beneath the mountain. 3 years earlier, he'd fallen off the lodge roof shoveling snow and broken his leg. The doctor told him he was a damn fool to be working up there at his age. "Damn it," Truman shot back. "I'm 80 years old, and at 80, I have the right to make up my mind and do what I want to do." As eruption threatened, the authorities told everyone living in the vicinity to clear out, but Truman wasn't going anywhere. For more than 2 months, the volcano smoldered. Authorities extended the evacuation zone to 10 miles around the mountain. Truman stubbornly remained. He didn't believe the scientists, with their uncertain and sometimes conflicting reports. He worried his lodge would be looted and vandalized, as another lodge on Spirit Lake was. And regardless, this home was his life. "If this place is going to go, I want to go with it," he said. "'Cause if I lost it, it would kill me in a week anyway." He attracted reporters with his straight-talking, curmudgeonly way, holding forth with a green John Deere cap on his head and a tall glass of bourbon and Coke in his hand. The local police thought about arresting him for his own good, but decided not to, given his age and the bad publicity they'd have to endure. They offered to bring him out every chance they got. He steadfastly refused. He told a friend, "If I die tomorrow, I've had a damn good life. I've done everything I could do, and I've done everything I ever wanted to do." The blast came at 8:40